All right, this morning we'll start with the parable of the workers in the vineyard in 21:16. And this connects with the context, because in chapter 19, verse 30, it said, "But many who are first will be last, and the last first." And you'll notice chapter 20 begins with the word "for," and that is a connector word, maybe an unfortunate chapter division here. Also, besides that "for," in Matthew 19:30, which we just read, and look at 20:16, "So the last shall be first and the first last," that also connects it. So if you put those two things together, we're going right along in the context where we were last week. Now, let's read the parable of the workers in the vineyard. Chapter 20, verse 1. "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. When he agreed with the laborers for a denarius for the day, he sent them into his vineyard. And when he went out the third hour and saw others standing in the marketplace, and to those he said, 'You also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right, I will give you.' And so they went. And again he went out about the sixth and ninth hour and did the same thing. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing around and said to them, 'Why have you been standing here idle all day long?' And they said to him, 'Because no one hired us.' And he said to them, 'You go into the vineyard too.' When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last group to the first.' And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each received a denarius. And when those hired first came, they thought that they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they grumbled at the landowner, saying, 'These last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the scorching heat of the day.' But he answered and said to one of them, 'Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go, but I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. Is it not lawful for me to do with what I wish with what I my own? Or is your eye envious because I am generous? So the last shall be first and the first last.'" I'll read what Alfred Plummer says in his commentary. He says, "As to the landowner's fairness, there can be no question. He kept faith with those who made an agreement with him, and he was the sole judge of what the work of the others was worth to him." Now, if we had that happen today, a union boss would be there and would complain, but we don't. We're back in Jesus' time, and the landowner could do what he want with what he had. Today, I know it's hard for us to understand, but a person could do with what he wanted with what he had. And the point of the parable is that God will graciously do more for some than some of those who work for him than justice seems to demand. And there's a reason for that, and I can explain this parable and probably make it clear to you in one sentence. It's just this: the criteria is what they did with what they had. That was his criteria for paying the workers. The 11th hour workers didn't have the opportunity to work the full day because no one hired us, they said. To these, the landowner was gracious because they used that opportunity they were given to work. So he paid them the same. Similarly, and this is where the parable affects us in the life to come, Jesus will take into account the circumstances of the work and opportunities taken in the giving of rewards. So when we stand at the Bema seat, well, better turn to 2 Corinthians 5:10. 2 Corinthians 5:10, where it says, For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body, according to what he has done, whether good or bad. So there will be, I hate to say judgment, that word judgment is kind of strong there. The word is bema. It means simply a race platform where awards are given out. It doesn't have anything to do with punishment. It's all rewards. So believers can look forward to rewards for what they've done in this life. No punishment, but rewards. And that reward is going to be based on what you did with what opportunities you had. So one person may get more rewards for doing less works than another person. And then that's the parable of the workers in the vineyard, because Jesus is going to take that into account. I think there are going to be some surprises at the bema seat. I think maybe a pastor will have to stand aside and wait for his janitor to get his reward, because he did the best with what he had. And that's the point of the bema seat. We are rewarded for the opportunities we have and what we do with them. Therefore, God acts, under 2015, the landowner acts in grace. He says, is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with what is my own? Or is your eye envious because I am generous? Now, Jesus is going to be generous. He's going to take into account how, you know, someone could become a believer on his deathbed and laying in the hospital witness to every nurse that comes through the door. And that's going to be worth a reward. But he doesn't have much time. So Jesus will take that into account. So the rewards are of grace, not strictly of works. Works enter in. What you do in this life has eternal consequences. But that is not the only thing that enters in when giving rewards. The circumstances enter in also. So think about that the next time you have an opportunity. If you take that opportunity, you will receive a reward. If you don't, you're not punished, but you lose rewards. That's the only punishment at the bema seat, is loss of rewards. And then he says in the last verse, in verse 16 there, so the last shall be first and the first last. So according to human viewpoint, the one who is first will be last, and the one who is last will be first. If a person becomes a believer and does nothing through his whole life but try to acquire wealth and maybe he'll die with a Lexus. That doesn't matter. He'll be last in the reward seat. It's the person who does God's work with the circumstances and opportunities that he has that counts. So it's eminently fair. Now in 2017 through 19, we have instruction concerning the passion. We've had some before, but this is going to be more thorough. 17 through 19 says, as Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves, and on the way he said to them, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and they will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him, and on the third day he will be raised up. This is the third announcement of his death and resurrection, and this is by far the most detailed. In Matthew 16:21, the Lord said his sufferings were necessary. Remember back there, he used the word day for necessary, and that word day in Greek is a word, it's a very strong imperative. It means it must be done. The same word he used to Nicodemus when he said, you must be born again. He's on his way now to Jerusalem where these things will take place. So we're getting close to the Passion Week here. In fact, if we have time, we'll get to the triumphal entry, but I don't think we'll have time for that. The response of the disciples isn't given here. But we can see from future events that they didn't understand. Remember we talked about a curtain? in a previous lesson, whenever Jesus got to talking about his death and resurrection, a curtain kind of fell over the eyes of the disciples. They just refused to believe that he was going to die and be resurrected. Now in verse 20 through 28, we have a section of teaching concerning position. Verse 20 says, "And then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him. And he said to her, 'What do you wish?' And she said to him, 'Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit on your right and one on your left.' But Jesus answered, 'You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink?' They said to him, 'We are able.' And he said to them, 'My cup you shall drink, but to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those whom it has been prepared by my Father.' And hearing this, the ten became indignant with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many.'" Now the then in verse 20 moves us on to the next subject, position in the kingdom. And there's an interesting point to be made here. If the kingdom was merely in the hearts of believers, as 80%, I think, of the nominal church believes, if the kingdom is just in the hearts of the believers, then Jesus would have surely corrected the disciples here, so close to the crucifixion. Instead, he corrects their concept of greatness in the messianic kingdom. And that's a good argument for a literal kingdom. And this little section shows that the disciples did not understand what Jesus had said. Despite Jesus' repeated predictions of his passion, two disciples and their mother are still thinking about privilege, status, and power in a kingdom that's just about to come. They're still thinking about that. So they didn't understand that the kingdom has been postponed yet. The word cup in verse 22, Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink?" The word cup there refers to a destiny of suffering, and it does all through the Bible. Look back at Psalm 11. We'll see it clear back there. It was used in the Old Testament of the suffering caused by God's wrath against sin. In Psalm 11 and verse 6, where it says, "Upon the wicked he will rain snares, fire and brimstone and burning wind will be the portion of their cup." So it's used of God's judgment in the Old Testament, his wrath against sin. And he's going to take judgment in the New Testament. The disciples had failed to learn the lesson of humility, which the king had been teaching in chapters 18 and 19. This lack of humility is seen in the request of James and John for places of prominence in the kingdom. He's just been teaching them over and over and over and over about humility. The first will be last, the last will be first, and they just fail to get the picture. They want to be first. They want to be the premier place in the kingdom. In fact, the indignation of the rest of the disciples showed that they wanted it too. So they were not paying attention to the king's teaching. Their lack of humility is indicated by the fact that the king had to instruct them further along these lines up in 25 through 28 that we just read. He uses the example of Gentiles there. In chapter 18, he used the example of children. And here in chapter 20, he makes a contrast with earthly rulers when in verse 25 when he says, "But Jesus called them to himself and said, 'You know that rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. So wanting to be greatness will result in being a servant. So in the kingdom, the secular principle of greatness is reversed. It's kind of turned on its head. The teaching of greatness, this section, is even more direct, more forcible than the king just completed in 1927 through 2016. So he's really hammering on this subject of humility in this section. That tells me that the natural, put in quotations, sin nature, human concern with status and importance, is clearly one of the most fundamental instincts which must be unlearned by those who belong to God's kingdom. You know, human viewpoint says that greatness means you're the boss of the whole company. Greatness means you drive a limousine. That's going to have to be turned on its head. And in the kingdom, the servant will be the great one, and the slave will be even greater. These guys, these 12 disciples, were heirs to the kingdom, but were not yet prepared for authority in the kingdom. A great lesson is taught in chapter 20, 20 through 28, about greatness, the section we just read. And that is, it comes by humility. Greatness in the kingdom comes by humility. Jesus is hammering this into the disciples over and over again. It shows that the disciples did not understand. They wanted greatness. I want to be on your right hand. I want to be on your left hand. The disciples just didn't understand this. Greatness comes by being a servant. Primacy comes by being a slave. Servant is the word diakonos, one who gets something done at the behest of a superior, according to Bauer, Arndt, and Gingrich. The root is dioko. It's a word that means to move rapidly and decisively toward an objective, to hasten, to run, to press on. And the word slave, doulos, means being under someone's total control. Probably from the word deo, to bind, it's the bondman representing the permanent relation of servitude. Doulos is someone who is owned. It's like owning a piece of furniture. You own this person. He's a slave. So he's the one that is superior to the servant who just does something at someone else's behest. So there's a progression here. The more humble you are, the higher you are in the kingdom. So it's flipped upside down according to human viewpoint. Verse 20, 28 points out the supreme example of humility and greatness when it says, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Christ could not give the places of preeminence to James and John. Why? Well, that's based on servitude. He did tell them they would sit on 12 thrones and judge the tribes of Israel, but he didn't tell them who's going to be on his right-hand side and who's going to be on his left. That's based on humility. Notice in verse 23, we might get a bad impression here. It said, he said to them, my cup you shall drink, but to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give. Now that but might seem to indicate that he is somewhat less because it's not his ability to give to who will sit where. The thing to notice is the but doesn't occur in the original. This sentence does not detract from the person of Christ in any way, if you think it does. Christ could not arbitrarily give these places to the disciples. Why? That is for the Father and Him alone. Now the humility of Christ. If humility is the prerequisite to greatness, Christ is the greatest since He is infinitely more humble than any human ever was, is, or shall be. Only God can pay the ransom. And that's the supreme act of humility when Christ paid the ransom for many. And I have in my notes, he could pay the ransom for many. he's the only one who could pay the ransom for any. Now stop and think about this just for a second. If the punishment for sin, and we've all sinned, is eternal separation from God, and eternity never ends, then none of us can ever pay, because eternity will never end, to pay the price. Christ paid the price. Only God could pay that price. So you could say that Christ was separated from God for eternity in the hours that he was on the cross. Just in those few hours, he could pay the price for eternity. Why? Because he lives outside of time. He's not bound by time. So eternity to us is different from eternity to God. And he could pay that price. And he did pay that price. He bore the penalty of eternal separation from God for all believers. For all man, and as a matter of fact, I'm a believer that his ransom paid the penalty for all sin, not just the sins of believers. The revelation of Christ's work. Before this time, Christ had asserted that he would be crucified, but he never said what that would accomplish. In Matthew, so far, we've had several times that Christ had predicted that he would suffer and die, but he never said why. Here, he says why. In verse 28, it says, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. So he gave his life as a ransom for many. A.T. Robertson, the great Greek scholar, wrote this. The word ransom, or lutron in Greek, is one commonly employed in the papyri. I should probably explain papyri. In the Middle East, the climate is very arid and very dry, and there are sand dunes, and that is a perfect place to preserve old documents because it's so dry. They don't get attacked by the things that attack our paper here. And they have found documents in garbage dumps, actually, is one of the primary places they looked for the papyri in the garbage dumps, because people would throw away old pieces of paper that they were done with, and they can get an idea of what these words mean by reading those papyri. If we have a word that occurs only once in the Bible, say only twice in the Greek New Testament, it's kind of hard to get a handle on exactly what that word means. You know, we can go to the lexicon, but that just gives us a lexicon dictionary. If we go outside the Bible to the papyri, we can see how it was used by the common man. And there are thousands upon thousands of these papyri, and that's what A.T. Robertson is quoting here. He said, the word translated ransom, lutron, is one commonly employed in the papyri as the price paid for a slave who is then set free by the one who bought him. And that's the word that Christ used for ransom. The word that means the price paid for a slave who is then set free by the one who purchased him. Now in 29 through 34, we have the healing of the blind men. Let's read that section. Verse 29, as they were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. And two blind men sitting by the road, hearing that Jesus was passing by, cried out, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. The crowd sternly told them to be quiet, but they cried out all the more, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. And Jesus stopped and called them and said, what do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, Lord, we want our eyes to be opened. Moved with compassion, Jesus touched their eyes, and immediately they regained their sight and followed him. Now Matthew continues to trace the journey, the final journey of the king to Jerusalem, the capital city. And on his way to suffer and die, Jesus continues to serve. Now notice the emphasis on two blind men here in this section. Two blind men. Matthew emphasizes the number to And another indication that he's writing to a Jewish audience is that the number 2 was the minimum number to establish the truth of a testimony. So they had to have 2, and there were 2 blind men. Mark mentions only 1 beggar, but then he's writing to a Gentile audience, and it wouldn't mean anything to them whether it was 1 or 2. So Matthew mentions 2 blind men, and the title Son of David that they give him, they say, Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David. That's an indication that the blind men believed Jesus to be the Messiah, because that's a term for Messiah, the Son of David. Now contrast that with the multitudes who are crying out Jesus is passing by. They just see the man. They don't see the Messiah. It's just Jesus. It's not Son of David. Now that indicates a lack of belief. They were probably following him for his healing miracles or were simply on their way to Passover. Now Passover's coming up in our text here. And the roads would have been packed at this time of year because every adult male had to go to Passover in Jerusalem. So the roads would have been purely packed. Now we have in 21, 1 through 17, the formal presentation of the king. And this is going to be his formal presentation. First, the preparation in 1 through 7. The phrase, and when, in 21, when they had approached Jerusalem, marks the transition in the narrative. Now we're on to something else, and that will be the triumphal entry. The careful preparation that the Lord makes here marks his sovereignty. What is about to happen is no accident. Detailed and deliberate instructions are given to the disciples. It's said, and I don't know if it's true or not, it could be true, but some say that went and arranged for the donkey the day before to have it ready for the disciples to get. Let's read 1 through 7 in verse 21. When they had approached Jerusalem and had come to Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent 2 disciples, saying to them, go into the village opposite you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied there and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me. If anyone says anything to you, you shall say the Lord has need of them, and immediately he will send them. This took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. Say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, gentle and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. The disciples went and did just as Jesus had instructed them, and brought the donkey and the colt and laid their coats on them, and he sat on the coats. So that's the preparation, and it's no accident. Again, Jesus may well have arranged for the donkey. We don't know. In this situation, the Lord was not in a position of him being the center of a clamor of people. He is actually going to cause the clamor here. Previously, remember, after his rejections was evident, he carefully withdrew from the cities and the religious leaders. He always withdrew. Now he intentionally, openly parades into Jerusalem. He manifests great authority here. In verse 21:3, it says, if anyone says anything to you, you shall say, the Lord has need of them. It's kind of interesting that this is the first place and the only place in Matthew where the words ha kurios, that means the Lord in Greek, are applied to Jesus. And here he applies it to himself. The term denotes power. It denotes authority. It's used for people of high authority. And it's used for the Lord. But this is the only place it occurs in Matthew. We're going to stop here today because we don't have time to look at the fulfillment of prophecy, because we'll have to go back to the Old Testament, especially if you want to read ahead for next week. Read Zechariah 9:9 and Daniel 9:24 through 27, because they both apply to this section that we're coming up to, the section when he comes into Jerusalem, and it's called Palm Sunday. You may have heard it called, or the triumphal entry is another word for it. I like triumphal entry better myself than Palm Sunday. And usually you have, in churches, you have a little group of children carrying palm branches down the aisle, which is nice. It's a good thing to do. Indicating palm trees, waving of palm branches was a way to welcome a king into a city. And that's why they did that on Palm Sunday. And we'll find out why Palm Sunday is significant. Prophetically, it's incredibly significant. And we'll find that out next week. Be patient until then. I know I'm quitting a little early today, but we don't have near the time to go into those two Old Testament passages. Father, thank you for your word, which is living and powerful. In Christ's name, amen.